the first decision in the famous Gobitis case used, as I said, to rationalize his result that the flag salute was constitutional by reliance upon the cases holding that the Mormons could not practice polygamy in spite of the fact that it was part of their religious scruples. But as I say, he was somewhat unsure in his presentation, although he voted to sustain it. All voted to sustain it. There was no discussion, no views expressed against it. Two members of the court, however, passed and didn't vote at that conference. One was Stone, the other was Black. Pusey's statement that at Roberts' suggestion, Frankfurter went to the Hughes, or said to Hughes, that Hughes should write the opinion, and that Hughes replied that he was going to assign it to Frankfurter, is not true. No one would ever suggest to Hughes that Hughes assigned an opinion to one person or another. Hughes was very severe. Frankfurter was very brash. But even Frankfurter would never have done, would never have dared to do that. Frankfurter, at that time, I was, I had never known Frankfurter very well. I was, I'd met him several times. I had thought of him as a great progressive liberal professor and student and advocate. I had held him in very high esteem. But after this case that Frankfurter, knowing of my close relationship to Hughes, called me into his office and asked me if I would go to Hughes and have Hughes assign the flag salute case to him to write. And I told him that I couldn't be any such errand boy, and that I wouldn't do it. Frankfurter, I think, was very upset. He was longing to get that opinion, and did get it, but it wasn't due to the intervention of anybody or to anybody's, as far as I know, although he, I say, he did try to get me to go to Hughes and have it assigned to him. He circulated his opinion, and there was some considerable discussion of it. I signed up with it, Hughes signed up with it, Black signed up with it, and everybody signed up with it except Stone. Nobody knew what Stone's views were. And Stone finally at one conference said that he was having trouble and he would circulate something that would indicate his position. And so it came out finally as a dissent, which ultimately became the law. Because when the Gobitis case was, by the time it came up for re-argument, for a petition for rehearing, Black and I had several discussions. We felt that we had probably made a mistake. We had we were beginning to have regrets. I think by the time it was re-argued, I haven't examined the records, but I think Murphy was on the court. I think Rutledge was on the court too.
In the second flag salute case, Rutledge and Murphy.
In the second flag salute case.
Murphy was on the court in the first.
Well, that's right. I'm sorry. Murphy was on the court in the first. He joined the Frankfurter opinion with Black and me, and it was Black and Murphy and I that in the following term had opinion. We thought we'd been taken in, and we mentioned it several times. It was a matter of that we wished we hadn't gone along, or that we wished we had had a re-argument. We wished we could have further consideration, and so on.
Right along with this, there has been a rumor that the day the Gobitis decision was supposed to come down, that Murphy had approached Hughes and asked to change his vote, and Hughes had refused him this. You may not know whether this is true or not, but does the story have anything of a true ring to it?
No, because up to the time the opinion is announced from the bench, anybody can change his views. And while I was there under Hughes, somebody, I forget the name of the case, changed his views about 11:45 before we went in and joined a dissenting opinion, making a 6-3 decision, a 5-4, as I remember. No, Hughes would be the last to say you can't change your vote. Hughes would say I have no jurisdiction over that. Hughes was meticulously proper in all of his relationships. He knew that every judge was sovereign and that he had no control over him. He never tried to exercise any control. He was the most meticulous Chief Justice that we've had in my time.
Well, right along the same lines, since you've been talking about your shift with Justices Black and Murphy, that came about in Jones versus this separate opinion that you three wrote in Jones versus Opelika in 1952. Can you put your finger on any particular factor or set of factors that acted as a catalyst in helping you to crystallize your philosophy?
I don't know if there was any one particular thing. We had been troubled at the time. We had joined up with the Frankfurter opinion before the next case. Before the next case came along, the second flag salute case, West Virginia v. Barnett, I think it was, decided in 1943, we had become pretty well separated from Frankfurter. This is nothing happened overnight. It was a evolutionary thing. Frankfurter had lost the respect of Black and myself and Murphy, just generally speaking. We learned that he was utterly dishonest intellectually, that he was very, very devious. We had none of us had known him very well, but he spent his time going up and down the halls, putting poison in everybody's spring, trying to set one justice against another, going to my office and telling me what a terrible person Reed was, or Black, going to Reed's office and telling Reed what a stupid person somebody else was, and so on. So we got a full measure of the intrigue of the man, of the manner of his operations, and we saw finally with something we probably should have seen at the time, that he was trying to introduce into American constitutional law system that seemed to us to be quite foreign to our constitutional scheme. Frankfurter is deeply and passionately devoted to the British system, to the supremacy of the legislative branch. Frankfurter thinks that the First Amendment, the Fifth Amendment, Sixth Amendment, and the Seventh Amendment, and the Eighth Amendment don't mean what they say. The only thing that means what it says is the Fourth Amendment. He defends the Fourth Amendment and a strict application of it because he says they are not an organized group and they have nobody to represent them. Therefore, the court should enforce it strictly. He would give the legislature great leeway to pass laws restricting freedom of speech, religion. He would not enforce the right to counsel and so on. He would take these commands of the Bill of Rights more or less as counsels of moderation or whatnot, as Learned Hand once put it. This was beginning to unfold in our minds, and we began to realize that here was a man who, instead of being a friend and a champion of civil liberties, was using his position on the court to line up allies for a constitutional doctrine that we couldn't go with. So the explosions in the conference had become more and more frequent, particularly between him and Black, between him and me, and we had become more and more suspicious of the good faith of the man, his intellectual honesty. We disagreed basically with him on many different things. So all of this shaped up to make the doubts that we had about the original flag salute decision become more and more important. But so by the time this other petition was filed in the Barnett case, we'd had Murphy and Black and I had many talks and decided that if it came up again, we would change our vote.
When the second flag salute itself was case was argued, were the divisions in the conference similar to the final one that were recorded in the U.S. reports?
Yes, they were. It was Stone. Jackson, I think, was assigned the opinion by Stone, Black, and Murphy, Rutledge, and I. It was 6-3, I think.
Yes.
And Frankfurter adhered to his original decision.
At the conference itself, was the opposition to reversal led by Frankfurter?
Yes. Yes, he held forth at great length.
Did any of the other, Reed and Roberts, I believe, joined with Frankfurt in dissent? Did they have much to say at the conference?
Roberts was a, for most of the time I was on the court, was a wonderfully pleasant, personable person who never took up much time in conference, merely stating his views and very briefly. He worked largely at the conference level in the tradition of Hughes. Reed was a little more outspoken, took a little more time, but neither one of them were they used the sort of filibuster kind of tactics that Frankfurter introduced into the court. And at this conference on the Barnett case, Reed and Roberts had very little to say.
This is an entirely new topic, but you have the reputation of being the quickest opinion writer since Holmes. While this facility has undoubtedly been sharpened by experience, did you have such speed and accuracy in research and writing when you first came to the court? Or have your procedures and opinion writing changed?
I never had any experience before in writing for the court. For opinions on any court. I've written, of course, many briefs and so on, many law review articles and whatnot. I think due to the fact that I was a commuter in the early years out of New York City, I learned to write with a pencil or a pen on a yellow pad on my lap, and that is the manner in which I've done all my work on the court. Taking briefs and records with me on airplanes and writing opinions as I crossed the country or out in the desert, Arizona, where I try to go in the wintertime, or wherever I might be. There's a charge made around some times by some outsiders that the judges assign their opinions to law clerks to write. I've never done that. I've written all my own opinions. I use my law clerk to do research for me. I often send him to a library to prepare a footnote to an opinion that I'm writing, telling him the cases pro and con that I want him to collect. Sometimes I ask him to prepare a digest for me to put in a footnote. My law clerk has the responsibility of approving all of my opinions for accuracy. I encourage controversy and debate in my office. I find the criticism that my law clerks give me very helpful. My law clerk writes a memorandum on all the certiorarys and appeals that come in, a very useful record. I make some notes on his memoranda, and they're good reference material, and particularly if the case comes up for argument or if it comes back for a rehearing. How do the other justices use law clerks to write opinions? I don't know. Under Warren, I think it was, the justices were given by an act of Congress or by an appropriation the right to have two justices, two law clerks per justice. And I tried two law clerks one term and found that it didn't work very well, so I only have one. The others have two. The Chief Justice has three. 1 year, Frankfurter brought on a man as a third law clerk, and he tried to get Warren to put him on the federal payroll, but Warren refused to do it. But this man worked in the library, and he wrote some of Frankfurter's long opinions. This law clerk wrote Frankfurter's opinion in the Sunday law cases that were decided. He wrote Frankfurter's opinion in the civil rights case where I wrote for the court coming out of Illinois as to what the meaning of under color of state law in the Civil Rights Act. The length of the opinions of some of the justices is, and they trend to develop in the court sort of law review articles as opinions, I think has been due to the extensive use by some justices, particularly Frankfurter, of law clerks in preparation of opinions.
Now, historically, the court has had its famous pair of justices, Marshall and Story, Holmes and Brandeis, and now Black and Douglas. Your views and Justice Black's on many fundamental matters are very much alike. And according to what passes as inside information in Washington, the ideological affinity between you and Justice Black is reinforced by a close personal friendship. Was this relationship a spontaneous one? I mean, when you first came to the court, did you immediately sense a kinship with Justice Black, or has this relationship been a product of long years of work for the same cause?
I had only met Hugo Black once before he went on the court. That time I was chairman of the, maybe not chairman, I guess just a member of the Securities and Exchange Commission. We were investigating companies, including the American Gas and Electric, and I had one man who was keeping track of all the legislation that was presented on the Hill. There were very powerful lobbies then, as now, trying to get bills through, and there was one innocuous-looking bankruptcy bill that came through that on its face seemed to mean nothing much. But those who knew the problems of this particular utility company and read this bill several times realized that it fit this company just like a glove, and only this company, although it was cast in general terms, and would relieve this company of the rigors of the reorganization that was in store for them. It had passed the Senate and the day before, and I rushed over to the cloakroom and asked to see one senator, and he wasn't there. I asked to see another one. Then I said, "Is Black there?" And Black came out, and I knew that he had been a great campaigner against the utilities. He'd been a great sponsor of the Holding Company Act of 1935. He conducted many investigations. So I told him that he and his colleagues had just done the utility company that he had most despised, the greatest favor that anybody had ever done it. And he asked me what he had done, and I told him. He said, "Are you sure?" And I said, "I am sure. Are you positive?" He said, "I'm positive." I said, "I'm positive." Well, he said, "I'll get the bill recalled." I'd forget the Senate procedure. That was the only time that I'd met Hugo Black, and I didn't know much about him, except he was from the South, except that he was very active as an investigator. And so the relationship between Black and me was one that developed while I was on the court, and didn't blossom suddenly. It was a long-term development. And actually, personally, Black and I have never been very close. I very, very seldom see him. We're very seldom together socially. It's more just a happenstance, I think, that we have found generally some kinship, although Black and I very often disagree on important matters.
Yes. During the 1939 term, President Roosevelt appointed Frank Murphy to fill Pierre Spotley's chair. Do you know anything of the background of this appointment?
No, I do not. I know that that Frank Murphy was anxious to move on from the office of Attorney General to some other post. I don't think that he had the court particularly in mind. I think Frank Murphy's real preference would have been to be Secretary of the Army. Some other cabinet post than Attorney General. I think that Roosevelt named him because he was had a liberal background, liberal tradition, and because he was Catholic. Pierce Butler was a Catholic, and I think Roosevelt merely followed along the pattern of having a Catholic on the court. I don't forget how many Catholics have been on the court. I never talked to Roosevelt about Murphy's appointment. I'm just surmising that it was because, not because he was a Catholic, but because he was a Catholic with a with a liberal philosophy that was generally in accord with Roosevelt's ideas.
In answer to question 12, in our last session, you had mentioned that at the conference in which the second Flagsmith case was discussed, that Mr. Justice Frankfurter carried on in his discussion what amounted to a filibuster. I wonder if you would just perhaps a few more words describe this particular conference.
I don't know that it was any longer than many of the, or most of the Stone regime conferences. I think I said before that the conferences under Stone went to the great extreme of detailed, long, lengthy discussions, almost interminable, and the one on the Barnett case was of that variety, but how many hours were spent on that one case, I have no exact recollection.
All right, thank you. Well, then perhaps we could move on to the next question, which was referred to Justice Jackson when he was Solicitor General. He was Solicitor General during most of your first year on the court, and Attorney General during the next 21 months. And he had the reputation of, among practicing lawyers, of being a brilliant advocate. Was this your evaluation of him after hearing him argue such cases as the Sunshine Anthracite Company case? How would you compare him with men like Davis, Biddle, and Marshall?
Robert Jackson was an exceptionally able advocate. He made an extraordinarily good Solicitor General. I think that perhaps his happiest years in government were his years as Solicitor General. I think that while he was very ambitious to become Attorney General and did become Attorney General, that once the administrative tasks had settled on him, he did not like that office. But I think he thoroughly enjoyed being Solicitor General, and I would say, if I had to make up a list of the 10 best advocates before the Supreme Court during my tenure, I would certainly put Bob Jackson among the 10. He was a little less austere than people like Francis Biddle, a little less precise than people like Charles Fahey, who's subsequently Solicitor General, not as reserved and dignified as John W. Davis. I think Jackson basically was a good jury lawyer, and he talked to the court pretty much as I think he would talk to juries. Not just sheer oratory, but a lot of common sense and a lot of emphasis of the facts, turning of a phrase, figures of speech. He was extremely, extremely good as an advocate.
All right, well, while we're on this the Sunshine Anthracite Company case, Mr. Justice Roberts did not dissent from your opinion, even though he'd been one of the majority in the Carter Coal Company case in 1936. Now, either from your discussion at the conference or from his comments on your slip opinions, did you judge that he went along reluctantly, perhaps feeling it would do no good to protest, or that he had fully changed his mind, or was there some other alternative?
As I remember, Roberts at the conference followed the lead of the Chief Justice, who then was Hughes, and thought that the act struck down in the Carter case had been rewritten, revised, clarified, remodeled, so that it met the objections that he and the majority of the court saw in it the first time it was up. At least there was no protest on Robert's part, and of the nine, there was only one vote to reverse at the conference, and that was a vote cast by McReynolds. Butler, Pierce Butler, who was on the court at the time, passed. He did not vote. Roberts voted to affirm, as did the other eight members of the court.